Perhaps you've heard the verse, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." But what is this harvest? Why are there so few workers? And is that still true today? That's the mystery to solve with this lesson. Hello and welcome to the April 28th version of the Community Group Leaders Preparation Guide. Can you believe there's only three sessions remaining this semester? Amazing. You know what that means, of course. In of course critiques. They're right around the corner. I know you're excited, but hey, let me ask you a question. Now that you're getting the results, finally, what kinds of things would you like to know? Are there other questions that you wish you hadn't gotten feedback on? If you have any, let me know. We can change how we do those end of course critiques. It's also a good time to get people to start reflecting about the end of the quarter and see what people think. What's going to do the most good to help them get the tools and training they need to guide people to grow as joyful servants of Jesus. Also, and I know this is a repeat, but here the real meaning behind this. This is the time to be thinking about who to apprentice into either a guide or a host role. We want to be thinking about that right now. For example, what does your group look like in the fall? Is your group two groups in the fall? And if so, who are the leaders? Who are the guides and the hosts? The reason I say that now is we still have time for them to practice leading a discussion, practice setting up an event. But we're soon going to run out of that time and find ourselves in the fall with too few leaders. The recent interest that we had in increasing the groups showed us that we're not quite as ready as I think we'd like to be. If we do have an explosion of people between now and the fall, we're not going to be prepared unless we have those leaders ready to go. So I'm hoping God bless His word serve richly. I'm hoping that we have an explosion of people. And so I'm hoping that we're all taking the task to apprentice and to grow new leaders as seriously as we can. So keep encouraging, keep supporting people, keep challenging people, and thank you for the awesome job that you're doing. I know that there are leaders waiting in the wings in some cases, but I seriously hope that it won't be enough and that God blesses us richly. All right, on to today's lesson, harvest plentiful and workers are few. If you get out your leader's guide, you can follow along with me. The main objective of this lesson is going to be very practical. We're trying to connect our everyday faith to life as it applies to the Huggins area, primarily because we're just coming off of Word Serve Love Huggins Sunday, where we're going to adopt them and promise that we will help them raise this new generation. But it also applies to any family that lives within the Huggins area that might be impacted. If you, for some reason, have to cut this lesson short, I would highly encourage maybe just skipping direct to the Taking It Home section and try to identify concrete ways that we can get our faith connected to serving at Huggins. And the Taking It Home section we'll talk about a little bit later, but if you have time just for a few questions, I would cut to the chase and go straight there for this lesson. But we're not going to do that. We're going to talk about a few things first here, because in the first question we talk about the people that Jesus encounters in Matthew 9. He calls them helpless and confused or harassed, depending on your translation. There are a couple of pieces of imagery here that are working in the background. They're kind of like a script. If you're a Jewish person, you would have these, quote, scripts running through your head. One of these pieces of imagery is the Jewish imagery of a shepherd. Jesus is not liking what he's seen in terms of the Jewish people, because the imagery of a shepherd is what Jesus' ideal leader would be. If you think about what a shepherd does for the sheep, it's basically an image of caring, of protecting, of nurturing, of getting people where they need to be and what they need to have. One of the most famous examples, I think, would be the Old Testament Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." It's the shepherd in Psalm 23 that makes the sheep to lie down beside the green pastures and in the green pastures beside the still water. So that's the imagery of leadership that the Jewish people and Jesus in particular would be expecting. So what's the problem? Well, compare that beautiful imagery of a shepherd to a Pharisee. That's who the leaders of Jesus' time were. And you'll see why Jesus is so upset and doesn't have very kind words for the Pharisees. They're not very good shepherds. They're pretty good at taking care of themselves and getting status and getting the best seat at banquets. but they're terrible shepherds. Jesus knows that, and that's part of the reason he thinks why all these people are helpless and confused. Their leadership is terrible. There's another piece of Jewish imagery at work here, and this is a bonus to the podcast only, so don't tell anybody. But the other piece of imagery is this idea of the Lord of the harvest. Throughout the Old Testament, God is often seen as a gardener or a vine dresser, and the garden or the vine is considered to be Israel in the Old Testament. So God would tend, God would nourish, God would nurture, and bring along the people of the faith. This idea was very common throughout the Old Testament, especially in some of the prophets. Now, notice one thing about that relationship. The gardener does not make fruit happen. The gardener does not make a plant mature. It happens with the cooperation of the plant, and it's a process. So in similar terms, God doesn't make people believe. God doesn't make people behave. That has to come from the people. That has to come from a commitment from the heart of the people. And that's what is lacking here. God's doing everything he can to have the chosen people exalt him and live in a way that reflects him. But they're not really following through. And that's part of the problem. There's also some cultural issues going on with these helpless and confused people. Obviously, living under occupation by the Roman Empire would be very difficult. There was not a lot of happy people. There was a lot of talk of rebellion, revolution. And any time that would happen, the Romans were known for putting that down very quickly and very violently in brutal fashion, sometimes lining the roads with the bodies crucified along crosses as a reminder for anybody else who might be considering resisting the Roman Empire. So there's a lot of stress in the everyday lives, especially when people started using words like Messiah or new leader or movements or things like that. So yeah, they're harassed, all right. The Romans weren't the best, most compassionate, benevolent rulers. So there's a lot of constant unrest, a lot of undertones politically. Then we look at not just the cultural issues, but Jesus' response here. Notice sometimes he preaches, sometimes he teaches, sometimes he heals. But notice the other thing, he always does it with compassion. You never see a sense of dutiness or tiredness of his spirit. You might seem exhausted and tired, but he always responds to the crowd. In the lesson plan, I've put several examples where you'll see a Jesus that is physically almost exhausted, but he sees these people's needs, and his compassion drives him to respond. That's real compassion. I don't know about you, but I don't really have that. I sometimes just get grumpy and tired. I don't know if you know anybody like that, but that might make a great discussion topic, if anybody does, to talk about what it is that makes them that way. What drives them to always be so compassionate? Is it something that we can imitate or something we can develop? The next piece of the lesson talks about does this condition of helpless, harassed, and lost people still happen today? I would say no and yes. No, we're not occupied by the Romans. Life's not quite that brutal. We're not scraping to get by. But yes, people are still confused and lost, but there's too much information. There's too much noise. The pace of life is so fast, we don't have time to listen or seek God. People are still in need of a shepherd, but the real question for today is, do they recognize that they're still in need of a shepherd? I don't think so in a lot of cases. And our lack of urgency in finding that shepherd might actually work against us. We don't have to think about life's struggles and life and death quite like they did back in those days. So we often put off thinking about what's important until a crisis hits. That's, I guess, good that we're not having so many crises, but it's bad in that we don't really stop and think about what's important. So, the next piece, how do we respond today? Well, I think we try to relate back to Jesus' response as best we can. We vary it, whether we teach or heal or preach or whatever, depending on what that other person needs. But I think we can also do that with compassion. Which leads to a great discussion set. What is that compassion? What would have to change in our lives to develop that kind of compassion? And how would we make those changes? How can we hold each other accountable? All right, moving on to the next major piece, the harvest being plentiful. What does the harvest mean? What does it look like to harvest? Well, if you don't remember anything else, remember this. The objective of Jesus' ministry was to make disciples, period. Notice it doesn't say make believers. It doesn't say make followers. Now, is there a difference between a follower and a disciple? Is there a difference between a disciple and a believer? Or is it just semantics? Well, let's start with this. What's a disciple? A disciple is one who's in the process of becoming like their teacher. In the case of Jesus' disciples, they're people who have counted the cost, they're willing to pay that price, they're wholly committed. Now, let me give you some examples of people in the Old Testament that maybe didn't suit that. How about the rich young ruler? If you remember, he had everything in terms of knowledge. He knew all the right answers, he could quote the law, he even followed the law, but he followed out of his head. Because when Jesus looked into his heart and saw that his riches were really what he loved the most, Jesus challenged him on that. He said, here's the one thing that you have to do to follow me, to be a disciple committed to me. You have to go and sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And what happened to that rich young ruler? He couldn't do it. He couldn't commit. He had everything in the way of head knowledge, but he didn't have his heart committed. That's a person I would call maybe a believer or a follower, but not a disciple. Do you see the difference? Interestingly enough, in the next few chapters of Matthew, we're going to see exactly what a clear definition of harvest being plentiful looks like in the Great Commission. In Matthew 28:18, Jesus is basically saying, go make disciples of all the nations. All the nations sounds like a harvest that is plentiful. Sending his disciples to make disciples of all the nations by teaching them to obey, by baptizing, by all the things that he sends them out to do, is sending workers. This idea of praying to the Lord of the harvest to send workers out has an interesting tie here, because in the Great Commission, Jesus is speaking to his apostles. The word apostle literally means the sent ones. So what you have in the Great Commission is the Lord of the harvest, God, sending the apostles, the sent ones, to make disciples, to harvest. Kind of cool how all that comes together, eh? So, yeah, that's another podcast bonus, by the way. Won't find that one in the lesson plan. See how cool it is to listen to the podcast? Anyway, I digress. So when it comes to us dealing with this plentiful harvest, how will we do it, or how do we do it in comparison to Jesus? Well, first of all, I would say be careful comparing ourselves to Jesus. We're never going to do it quite like he did. But yet, there's some good news in that too, because not even Jesus convinced everyone to become a disciple. It takes a little pressure off us. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but it does mean not everybody we meet is going to become a disciple of Christ, and that's okay, because not even Jesus pulled that off. But I think one of the things that we can look at is our approach. When we compare ourselves to Jesus, there's a temptation to say, well, I couldn't possibly do that. Well, I'm just not going to bother. Or I can't heal like Jesus did. I can't cleanse a leper. So I'm just not going to bother. He must be talking to somebody else. Well, first of all, let me say this. He is talking to us. He does have expectations of us. Remember the Great Commission? It says to go and make disciples, teaching them to obey and baptizing them. It doesn't say we have to be as spectacular as Jesus. And if you're worried about not being able to heal a leper or straighten a crippled person, consider what healing really means. I don't doubt that some people can lay hands on people and heal. I don't doubt that some people can speak a word and see healing. But they're very few and far between. But consider this. Have you ever thought about the impact that your words might have or your actions might have towards healing? How about your listening? Can your listening to someone help them heal, help them get back to wholeness? Can a word of encouragement from you begin a healing process in someone? Basically, anything that would bring a person back to wholeness and wellness and peace sounds a lot like healing to me. And consider this also. Maybe that little thing that we do, that word of encouragement or that listening ear, is just part of a bigger team. and we never see the whole picture. But when God chooses to use his people to heal others, and everybody plays their part, we're going to experience things that we can't explain, not in our lifetime and not in our capability. But God doesn't ask us to have that full picture. He just asks us to do our part. So if God's asking, then why are there so few workers? Well, look at the job descriptions. I mean, if this question falls flat in your discussion group, why are there so few workers, you might try just jumping right ahead to that next question. What would it take to be one of these workers? Well, what it would take would be a disciple, someone who's totally committed. Totally committed after having counted the cost and being willing to pay that price. Do you remember the JOY acronym? It's the priority of how we should live. Jesus first, others second, yourself last. JOY. The reason I think that there are so few workers is there are so few people who qualify, because they won't put Jesus first, or they won't put themselves last. There's not a lot of people qualified, and not a lot of people looking for the job of worker. And quite frankly, our modern self-centered culture doesn't really condition us that way. So few workers, you bet. And that's our choice. But that's not a good choice. The last part of that question talks about Jesus' motivation for what he does. And I think we've alluded to this already. It's always a sense of compassion. So take a look at the lesson plan. There's some other good discussion there. And it would make a great series of questions to kind of probe that idea of how can we up our compassion a little bit? How can we become passionate like Jesus, serve people with that compassion? All right, the last piece of the lesson is the taking it home section. Like I said in the earlier, this is the main point of this lesson. We really want to try to match our gifts with the needs of the people around us. And we want to do it in a way that we meet people where they are, but not leave them where they are. The last page of the guide there has a model called the Kingdom Concept Model. It was put together by a guy named Will Mancini when he wrote a book called Church Unique. I think it's pretty fairly self-explanatory, but let me just reiterate. We're looking for that sweet spot where three things come together. A need, your capability to meet a need, and the ability to get fired up about that. Where those three things come together, then you've got a kingdom concept and you've got some really effective ministry. I'll give you one example. I volunteered to tutor reading because I heard about a need to increase reading scores. So there was a need. Also happened to be a capability because as a part of my degree, I have a minor emphasis in teaching reading. And I love to read. So there's the three things. There was a need to teach reading. There was a capability. It was part of my background. And there was a passion for reading because I love to do it. So great way to find that sweet spot. And when I do that, I love it. Now I realize that my schedule is different. I'm trying not to toot my own horn here or put expectations on everybody else. But I'll bet you can find examples where you can serve too. Where you have a need, or where you see a need rather, where you have a capability and you can get fired up about meeting it. Wherever that is, find that sweet spot and find a way to serve. Well, let me just wrap up this lesson with a couple of thoughts here. What was true back in those days, that's still true today. There are lots of people who don't know Jesus. The harvest is still plentiful. But it's even more than just that, not knowing. And perhaps even more tragically, there are people who know Jesus, but they just know about him or know of him. They're just like the followers in that crowd that are kind of hanging out because they're curious or they want to see something. They want to see entertainment or a miracle. Or they want something from Jesus. But are they really committed? Are they willing to be harvested? Are they willing to become a disciple? Now, why does that question really matter? Does it matter? Well, here and now it matters because it's going to take commitment to make a real difference in living out our faith. It's going to take commitment to change our community one relationship at a time. It's going to take commitment to create and sustain a lifestyle that's willing to go against the grain of this culture. People are going to consider us odd, different. Why would you lead a life that creates margin like that? That's wasted time. Why would you give your time or your money to other people who probably don't deserve it? That takes commitment. And that's the here and now. But in eternity, it's going to get even more important. Because there'll be those who know of Jesus in their heads, but they don't know him in their hearts. Do you remember a few weeks ago when we talked about the heart and what it represents, the total commitment, the seat of what we do? That's going to be what it takes to be one of the workers and to enter into the kingdom. But don't take my word for it. Listen to the words of Jesus himself in Matthew 7:21. Jesus says this, "Not everyone who calls out to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Only those who actually do the will of my Father in heaven will enter the kingdom of heaven." Those are some pretty powerful words. How do we prevent that from happening? How do we prevent from being locked out? Well, we commit. And not just with our heads, with our whole hearts. We become part of that harvest that Jesus says is plentiful. And then in turn, we become the workers in that very same field. Listen, thanks again for all you're doing in those fields. I'm honored to be working with some of the best workers I know. Keep up the great work and be blessed, and then be a blessing to others as we solve the mystery of the harvest and the few workers. Have a great day.